The following is a recording for the Israel Project on Wednesday, May 8, 2019 at 9 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we now have our presenters in conference. Please be aware, each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentation, we will open the floor for questions. At that time, instructions will be given to the procedure to follow if you'd like to ask a question. I would like to now turn the conference over to Mr. Josh Block, President and CEO of the Israel Project. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Thank you all for joining us. And, Dennis, thank you for being here. Dennis, who really needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. Dennis here, of course, is a diplomat and an author and a Washington expert for quite a long time. He served as the director of Near East and South Asian Affairs in the National Security Council under President Reagan, the director of policy planning in President Bush Senior's State Department, the special Middle East coordinator and Middle East envoy under President Clinton, and special advisor for Persian Gulf and Southwest and Asian Affairs under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration. Dennis is just really one of the greatest folks around, and we're really glad to have him. The last few days, as we all have seen in Israel, have been quite tense with Hamas again, and this is a situation which is not going to go away, but and needs some ideas for resolution. And Dennis, you know, you've got some ideas along that line. And also, we've got the deal of the century coming up and all these things happening. So it's really a great time to have a few minutes with you, Dennis. I really appreciate it. And so why don't I turn it over to you, and then we'll follow up a few questions.
Okay. So, what we saw, the latest, blow up, is the only way to describe it, between basically Hamas and Israel. I describe it as the latest blow because in November you had about 36 hours where 500 rockets and mortars were fired at Israel from Gaza. There was a ceasefire then. There were certain understandings. One of the things that the Israelis permitted was money from Qatar to go to Hamas. And it actually not only did it address some of the financial needs, at least of Hamas, but it also, there was the amount of electricity a day was raised from about 4 hours a day to about 8 hours a day. Why do we see a breakdown now? You know, where we have 700 rockets this time with Hamas and Islamic Jihad also using a new set of tactics. They've always been interested in the idea that maybe they could saturate Iron Dome. But they did more of kind of directed firing at particular targets with larger numbers of rockets at the same time, hoping that, as I said, that would kind of overwhelm Iron Dome. Iron Dome was still pretty effective, but you do have four Israeli deaths this time, which we haven't seen previously. So what triggered this? I mean, you're seeing all sorts of interesting speculation now. Oh, it was Islamic Jihad and Hamas who looked at this, and they saw Eurovision coming up this week with lots of tourists, and they wanted to show that Israel, you know, maybe it wasn't such a great tourist destination after all, that, you know, that they couldn't go away. They want to lift the siege over Gaza and that Israel imposes, and that was the reason for it. I actually think it's probably a combination of factors, one of which is it was Hamas, I think, spurred on by the Iranians. The Iranians are looking for opportunities right now as they're under more pressure from us with the end of the oil waivers. They're looking to show, okay, we're going to be pressured. We have ways to pressure and create different kinds of consequences and costs for America and its friends. One of the reasons we're sending a carrier there is in response to intelligence we picked up, although the intelligence apparently had more to do with what might be Shia militia attacks on American forces. The fact is, I see all of this as part and parcel. This particular episode in Gaza was triggered by Islamic Jihad snipers wounding two Israeli soldiers along the border, along the Gaza fence. Israel then debated how to respond, whether to respond directly against Islamic Jihad targets or Hamas, and the decision was to hit Hamas with the theory that Hamas is the address, and Hamas can't allow Islamic Jihad to do these things. If it does allow it, then they're going to pay a price. And that, you know, that set in motion a train of events. Maybe the other factors about, okay, you've got Eurovision coming up, and other important Independence Day coming out of all this for Israel. Maybe that was a factor in all this, and they thought they could put pressure on Israel as a way of getting them to concede more. All these may have played a role. I think the other thing to bear in mind is you have a reality where, you know, the Prime Minister of Israel understands that sending Israeli forces in on the ground, which ultimately is the only way to stop the rocket fire, is very costly. The Israelis, if they do it, face what is likely a no-win prospect, where they go in, they clean out, you know, they basically decapitate Hamas, try to destroy the military wing, try to destroy the rockets. They're likely to lose a significant number of Israeli soldiers in the process because the, you know, the Hamas basically uses a civilian population as a shield for its weapons and its fighters. You're going to kill a lot of Palestinians in the process. At the end of the day, if you have succeeded in sort of decapitating Hamas and destroying the military wing, you're then stuck. You're in Gaza. What do? You either get to stay, and sooner or later you'll face an insurgency there, or you withdraw and you no longer have an address. You no longer have anybody you can hold accountable. So there's an unmistakable dilemma there. Now, it's not like, and I would say Hamas certainly recognizes this, but of course it's a risk they run too, because after all, they're the ones who'd be decapitated if they push this too far. But it's inherently unstable because, you know, every few months, if this is going to be the case, sooner or later the wrong target is going to be hit, and at that point you're kind of off to the races. So the question is, what could change this dynamic? And the one thing I would say, first I want to note, there's no simple answer to this. And anybody who thinks there's a simple answer to it is kidding themselves. But there is one interesting new factor in the equation. A month ago, there were 4 days of demonstrations within Gaza, and they were all against Hamas. You had a Palestinian set himself on fire in protest against the living conditions at Hamas. You had large demonstrations with people chanting, "We want to live." This wasn't geared against Israel. This was geared against Hamas. Sinwar, Yahya Sinwar, who is the leader, seems more attuned to the realities and the need to improve the realities, the day-to-day realities, lest Hamas lose any real credibility. It's not that Hamas is reluctant to be draconian in terms of response. The 4 days of demonstrations, they arrested over 1,000 people. They brutalized quite a few, trying to make examples of them. And yet, I think that there was a defensiveness because of this. I think they were more prone also to try to divert attention away because of this. But it doesn't change the reality that so much of what they're talking about with regard to putting pressure on Israel is to try to lift the siege so they can show that life will improve within Gaza. Now, I feel that they're more generally on the defensive, and that's why what I'd like to see is a broad international effort that would say the following. And this is very much linked, at least in practice, to what the UN and the Egyptians, really Nikolai Mladenov, has been trying to broker, which is a kind of three-phase process where in the first phase you get you address the electricity, water, and sewage treatment needs that are really profound in Gaza. 96% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable, and if nothing changes over the next year or two, all of it will be undrinkable. There needs to be some kind of intervention on that. The electricity issue, I said, the electricity went from 4 hours a day to 8 hours a day. Well, we got another summer coming up, and you can imagine what 8 hours a day of electricity is in a place like Gaza where it gets very hot. And so dealing with that at a certain level is one thing. But if you want to actually do what is most needed, there are, in Gaza, food is available, goods are available, but nobody has any money because, you know, you have over 50% unemployment. It's around 70% for those who are between the ages of 18 and 29. This is also, you know, a combustible mixture because if people have nothing to lose, it also makes it more likely you could have an explosion. So, you know, the idea of a three-phase process where you start dealing with what's the most immediate need, you then go into what could be more infrastructure development and job creation, and then you go into a final phase that deals more with reconstruction. But for this to really be something that would put Hamas in a position where they're on the defensive and need to find a way to respond, there needs to be a public mantra. It will be hard for us to lead that because the U.S. at this point, the administration at this point, doesn't have a lot of credibility with Palestinians, but it should certainly be part of the effort. It should be a major effort made with the Europeans to have the Europeans, maybe in conjunction with Mladenov and the U.N., announce a plan where they basically, they say, reconstruction for demilitarization. You know, the phase, and I, when I say this, I'm not naive. I don't, you know, for Hamas, which defines itself as a resistance movement, the idea that they're simply going to give their weapons isn't very realistic. On the other hand, you could start by saying, all right, to start this process, you know, there has to, all the tunnels have to be closed down in a verifiable way. There has to be monitoring of this. No more acquisition of rockets and development of that. No more testing of that. I mean, you could start with what are the things that contribute most to a threat out of Gaza to Israel, and basically say there can be reconstruction and present the plan, not just vague words, but outline specifically the kind of projects that would be possible and are available, and there's a commitment to pursuing, provided Hamas commits to taking these steps. Now, what it does, if nothing else, is it also shines a spotlight on what Hamas is doing, not just internationally, but also for Palestinians within Gaza, who obviously you wouldn't have 4 days of demonstrations if they didn't kind of get that. This will put more pressure on Hamas internally. And as I said, there, I believe there's signs of their genuine defensiveness. I think this at least allows you to sort of reframe the issues, put them on the defensive, get the focus more on what Hamas is doing that prevents construction and highlights that the conditions are terrible, but in no small part, Hamas is really responsible for that. Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So I just view this as also a possible way of at least starting a process that may not end with everything you want, may not lead to everything even that Hamas would seek, you know, or that the public in Gaza would seek. But at a minimum, it's likely to stabilize the situation and get us off this every few months. This notion of every few months you have this kind of a blow-up, it's not going to be tolerated. At a certain point in Israel, even with Netanyahu, who is clearly doesn't want to go in on the ground, you know, at a certain point, he won't have a choice. And as I said, the net result of that is Israel's back in Gaza or it has no address in Gaza. So something has to change or you're headed towards what becomes even a worse situation. And it's not just the battle between the battles, as the chief of staff, the new chief of staff, is now describing what's going on with Gaza. So why don't I stop there?
Well, thank you, Dennis. That was great. And you touched on a number of the issues that both I have had in mind to ask about, and I we have some had questions in the email queue already about. So let me circle back to some of those. And operator, if you want to give instructions for anyone to get in the queue now, that would be good. Go ahead and do that.
Thank you. At this time, we'll open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one now.
All right. Yeah. In the meantime, I've got some questions here. Noreen asked some same things along with Richard also. What kind of things, Dennis, is it that Israel is agreeing to inside the context of the negotiations with Egypt and Hamas, this three-way dialogue, every time we get this flare-up? What is it that, you know, Hamas says Israel agreed to list sanctions, the missile, what's going on here?
Okay, yeah, look.
And who's in charge? Who's in charge in this dialogue?
It's a dialogue that involves principally the Egyptians, Mladenov of the UN, and then the Egyptians being kind of the go-between. What is the essence of what's being agreed to is Israelis are allowing the Qatari money to come in, which allows Hamas, if nothing else, to pay their own people. It is also expanding the zone where Gaza fishermen can go out. So they're allowed now, according to the understanding, to go out to about 10 miles out. For a long time, they were restricted to 6 miles, and obviously you can deplete what's available within that space. So there is also the fuel. The Israelis are allowing more fuel to cross in, and that's what's allowing them also, therefore, to be able to increase the amount of electricity that's available. But there are other things that could be done that are part of what I would call just at the humanitarian level. There are projects that are low-cost projects, by the way, that could use, and this is not happening right now, but it could be part of what I would say phase one. Phase one would increase electricity, would basically allow you to, there are two big sewage treatment plants in Gaza, and they don't have the fuel to operate frequently. So it gets dumped into the Mediterranean, which, given the currents, ends up flowing towards Israel. So it's in Israel's self-interest to allow more of this. There are some low-cost solar fields, solar units that could actually, like for $15 million, would allow one of the sewage treatment plants to operate full-time. This is the kind of thing that you could do, and it's in everybody's interest to do it. So, but that could be part of this phased approach. Right now, the key to the agreements is more to do with letting the money come in, expanding the fishing rights for Gaza fishermen, and permitting more fuel to come through Kerem Shalom, opening up the Israeli crossing points and allowing more to go through. There is also a UN plan. And they have commitments, this is what Mladenov has commitments for some works projects which would get about $50 million to go in for Gaza works programs, which would employ people. And part of the problem, again, is they don't have money to buy. Just to put this in perspective, there was a time when Israel allowed 1,000 trucks a day to go into Gaza. They're not against allowing that many trucks. The problem is, it's more like about 150 a day because there isn't money to buy the goods that go in.
Right. Well, your point about the pressure that Hamas is facing now increasing and the riots that we saw on the streets and the kind of just basic public outcry about human needs is a very interesting question and what the leverage it creates. All right, operator, why don't we go to the queue for a question?
Thank you. Our first question comes from Alan Katz.
Good morning, gentlemen and ladies. Obviously, you can't make peace by yourself. It requires two people. Do you believe that the Palestinians really do want peace? And if you do, what is the evidence of that? Thank you.
Well, first, when you say the Palestinians, we have Hamas in Gaza, and we have the PA in the West Bank. I would say in the case of Hamas, they do not want peace. It goes against their complete ideology. Would they be prepared to accept some sort of longer-term ceasefire? Yeah, probably. But not because they want peace, but because they also want to take over the Palestinian movement. And yet, on the other hand, with Gaza being, this kind of ongoing dilemma at a minimum, if you can't stabilize Gaza, you're going to have an ongoing problem that would frustrate any effort at peace to begin with. So that's point one. Point two, your larger question is, do the Palestinians have any interest in peace, excluding Hamas? My answer to you is, yeah. I think most Palestinians would like peace. Why is it that 150,000 Palestinians work every day in Israel? Because they want war? No. Because they want to be able to live. And The question isn't whether they want peace. The question is under what terms? Because that's really the essence of what you're asking. You're asking, are they prepared to live with an outcome sort of side by side in peace, recognizing Israel as the state of the Jewish people? And I guess my answer would be probably most Palestinians would be willing to accept it, just because, again, I think they want to be able to live. But I think we're headed in a different direction. I think we're headed towards a different kind of reality. When you ask Palestinians, when you poll Palestinians under the age of 30, what they most want, the two highest responses are a job in Israel, and the second response is let the Israelis stay where they are, just give us the vote. And that's, you know, that's the problem with a one-state outcome, and that's kind of the path where things are headed at this point. But that's, you know, in answer to your question, you know, it's not do they want peace. The question is peace on what terms?
All right. Thank you. Operator, next in the queue.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cheryl Silver.
Yeah, good morning. Ambassador Ross, thanks so much for taking time this morning. I just happened to see a video very early this morning that was sent to me by a friend, a group, an ardent Zionist, that was done by a group in Florida called the United West. And apropos of what you're saying about what Palestinians themselves want versus Hamas and the government, this was an incredibly revealing 16-minute video showing how the Hamas leaders live, how Abbas lives, the mansion they have, the, you know, five-star hotels that some people have. And then they talked to Palestinians, regular Palestinians on the street, who complained mightily about the fact that they hear about the aid, but they never receive it, that their leaders, I mean, they're furious at their leaders. So my question is, what can we do, you know, in addition to, you know, listening this morning to a conference call like this and sharing, listening to your wisdom, what can we do to, my concern was I'd love to, you know, share this video I saw more widely with friends I have who are leaders of ZOA, Stand With Us, et cetera, et cetera, and the Christian Zionist community, but I want to, A, verify that this is really how it is in Ramallah and in Hebron. I mean, they are speaking on this 16-minute video to, you know, Palestinians. It's being translated into English. Obviously, I assume they're speaking in Arabic. So, you know, what can those of us do who want to make sure that this word gets out? Because Israel is fighting, you know, both a PR battle that's constantly waged against it, and at the same time they're trying to protect their citizens and keep everyone safe.
Yeah. Look, one interesting thing I just say apropos of what you're describing. I was asked yesterday, you know, what would happen if there were elections in the Palestinian areas? And I said, well, in Gaza, the PA and Fatah would win, and in the West Bank, Hamas would win. Meaning the alienation of the Palestinian public from their two respective leaderships is so high because of corruption and the like, that, you know, whoever is running against the existing leadership is likely to win if you actually had a fair and free election. And I think this message of what I was describing before, you know, the 4 days of riots and demonstrations with a Palestinian setting himself on fire in Gaza, you know, it got some attention, but it didn't get nearly as much as it should have gotten. It's a kind of, I mean, I think, you know, these kinds of realities need to be given greater exposure, number one. That's why I say this notion of, just think about it, you know, the create a mantra of reconstruction for demilitarization. What is going to be the defense internationally of Hamas should have rockets and you should have tunnels and the like in place of reconstruction? For those who want to put Israel in the docket over Gaza, I mean, after all, Israel did withdraw 100%, you know, creating this mantra of reconstruction for demilitarization makes it clear. Okay, you get reconstruction, but you don't get to have it with tunnels and rockets. I think that would do wonders, and it would also send a signal to Palestinians that, in a sense, their own frustrations are being heard. That's number one. I think something else needs to be emphasized. You know, I think that there needs to be a focus on Palestinian institutions. when Salam Fayyad was the prime minister, his approach was, look, let's not focus on trying to resolve all the issues right now between us and the Israelis. Let's focus on, let's build a state from the ground up. Let's build institutions. Let's build a rule of law. Let's build transparency in terms of how we do business. Let's fight corruption. And he said, let's take a page from what the Zionists. He basically said the Zionists built a state from the ground up so no one could deny it. Let's do that. And there should be a very heavy focus on Palestinian governance and institutions. It also, again, it shows you're listening to what are the real complaints and frustrations of Palestinians and what they face, but it also tends to divert attention to what are the more significant issues. You know, look, I'm still someone who believes in a two-state outcome, even if I don't believe it's achievable anytime soon. And I do believe in it because ultimately I don't want to see Israel become one state for two peoples, which is where I fear things could be headed, with Palestinians then saying, just having a mantra of one person, one vote. I think that is a real time bomb. But I think the key here is to also remind people that if you had a state tomorrow for the Palestinians, it would be a failed state. And we don't need one more failed or failing state. That's what creates all the openings for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so forth. So, you know, look, I think that I think trying to do all we can to give greater exposure to these kinds of things, I think this could make a difference. Not only does it tend to shift the focus away from the Israelis onto the Palestinians, but it also puts the focus on what really is needed on the Palestinian side.
Okay, thank you. And we got one more in the queue, operator.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dr. Murray Zucker.
Yes, hi. You know, given that Hamas holds their population hostage and shows little regard for their welfare, what's the prospect of using logic and carrots and sticks? And what about regime change? And what are the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Emiratis, what do they want to see happen?
Well, on the latter part, you know, the Egyptians are obviously accepting the Qatari money coming in, even though Egypt is fiercely against the Muslim Brotherhood, fiercely against Qatar, but they don't want to blow up in Gaza, so they go along with this. The Saudis, the Emiratis, they view the Muslim Brotherhood as just as much of a threat as they view Iran. So they would, you know, they certainly would like to see a change there, but the question is, how do you produce it? No one is going to send their forces in on the ground to do it. The one thing is, as I said, I do believe there is a defensiveness on the part of Hamas, and you can put them more on the defensive, and that can at least, once you begin to create some level of people going back to work in Gaza, it will also raise the cost of Hamas of then them upending that. So, you know, regime change is easy to say and hard to produce. And it sounds great, but there's no simple avenue for producing it. The question is whether or not, if you can at least create stabilization, does that create some potential to split Hamas over time? And if, even if you can't get complete demilitarization, if you can reduce the scope of what they have, that also creates perhaps more options against them over time. But I don't see a magic wand that you can wave and you can produce this. The Saudis and Emiratis are not sending any forces to Gaza. Egypt is not sending any forces to Gaza. And I don't see Israel going in. I can't say that Israel will never go in, because, as I said, I can see circumstances where in the end they just don't have a choice. But then, as I said, what do you do after you've decapitated Hamas when you've got Islamic Jihad there, you've got elements of ISIS there? You know, these are real dilemmas that you face, and there's not a simple answer to it.
Okay, Dennis, let's sneak in one last quick question if we can here. Maybe you're all done, Dennis. You're all right? Yeah? No time?
Go ahead.
Are we out of time? Okay, go ahead, operator, quickly.
Okay, our next question is from Neil Brownstein.
Good morning. The deal of the century is advertised as coming next month. Is that a Hollywood type fiction, or is there any merit to process starting or continuing?
Look, I think the key to it's going to be, I think first to understand, there isn't going to be a deal of the century. The gaps between the two sides are too great psychologically and substantively. In the best case, this would resume diplomacy. I think the key is going to be whether Arab leaders can find it as crossing, that it's serious enough in terms of what it offers to Palestinians, that they can stand up and say, we view this as a serious basis for negotiations. That actually could put Abu Mazen in a position where it would be hard for him to say no. But for it to do that, it probably has to cross thresholds on statehood and probably a capital for that state in some significant part of Arab East Jerusalem. If it doesn't do that, you're not going to get even those Arab states that are quietly doing an awful lot of business with the Israelis below the radar screen, you're not going to probably get them to even say it's serious. So I think there's still a lot of preparatory work that needs to be done on the ground. I think it needs to be clear that there's going to be some understandings in advance with the Arabs that are sort of ironed out about how they'll respond to it, even working out word for word what they will say. You know, I still think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. I would still myself start with, even before presenting it, I think it makes sense to try to come up with this kind of broader approach on Gaza that could stabilize things, because if you don't stabilize it before you present the plan, you could have a blow-up. The plan itself could produce an excuse for the Iranians and others to try to blow everything up at that moment. And Gaza represents the place where they most likely could do it. So I think you need to do stuff on the ground that could prepare the ground, that creates a better atmosphere for it, and then I think you really have to reach some understandings with Arab leaders if it is to have any chance. And so at this point, I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and it's not at all clear what will be the result if the plan is presented. It could be presented maybe a little later than June, and you know, it's not going to produce a deal. The best it can produce is a resumption of a diplomatic process. And that would be something, because that could at least begin to restore a sense of possibility. What I hope it doesn't do is I hope it doesn't make things worse, in that the PA rushes to say no. The Israelis then, especially with the new government they're likely to have, want to prove there's a cost for this. They begin annexation, even if they annex areas in the West Bank that everybody believes would be part of Israel in any peace agreement, it's not clear what the response of the Palestinian Authority is going to be at that point. Does security cooperation continue or not? Anyway, I got to go. Okay?
Thank you, Dennis. 30 minutes. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for supporting. Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate it. And, you know, as we heard, there were so many issues. We wish we had more time, and we'll do it again. I'm sorry we didn't get to every question. You can please reach out to the TIP staff if you've got more concerns. Of course, TIP was deeply engaged in the Gaza escalation this past week to ensure the coverage had proper context and the journalists had the resources to tell the story as well as they could. And the staff is happy to share with you some of that output. And of course, as we heard, there's much more to do. Another round coming with Hamas. Good ideas that we need to introduce into the conversation. And the very purpose of TIP is to drive these ideas into the conversation, and demilitarization in return for reconstruction is the kind of thing we need to start pressing into the conversation, into the dialogue. And of course, we need to continue to push back against Iran's malign efforts in the region. And of course, here at home, the rising tide of anti-Semitism and the language in the media and the press that we need to work to correct when it's inflaming the problem, not exposing it. Communication security that TIP provides for the Jewish people is incredibly important for Israel these days, especially when rhetoric can turn into, can manifest itself in real physical, realities. But of course, TIP can't do this work without your help. And so we're really grateful for you calling in. And for those of you, you know, asked Cheryl about what can we do about these things? I think that's the reason that we have these conversations. The reason that we exist is to share these ideas with you, with opinion leaders, with media, through social media and other ways to get these messages out. So we need your help. If you haven't made your pledge already this year or made your contribution, we would appreciate you doing that now. You can always go online or be in touch with anyone at the office. press at the Israel, press@theisraelproject.org. And my phone number, you can always call me. It's 202-316-3110. Thank you very much, everybody. We really appreciate your help. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's presentation. You may now disconnect.